You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. You may have heard that there's a floating island of plastic trash in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The truth is, there isn't. In fact, the problem is far more insidious. According to one estimate, there are hundreds of thousands of tons of plastic floating around in the world's oceans, and most of it is smaller than your pinky fingernail. Scientists at the nonprofit Five Gyres Institute helped produce that estimate. Five Gyres was created in 2009 to study the problem of ocean plastics and raise public awareness. Co-founders Anna Cummins and Marcus Erickson join me now. Welcome both of you to Living Lab.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You, I understand, met in 2008 and got engaged while on a plastics research expedition in the North Pacific, and then subsequently, I guess, pulled off a pretty amazing publicity stunt using 15,000 plastic water bottles and an abandoned airplane fuselage. Marcus, can you tell us that story?
Sure. So I guess it does start with the proposing to Anna. We're with our mentor, Captain Charles Moore, the guy that found the accumulation zone between Hawaii and California. That made the press big time at the beginning of this century. And we joined him in 2008, and I found some plastic fishing line floating by. I scooped it up in that expedition, made a little ring, and I found Anna sleeping in the sails, up on top of the deck. And I snuck there, snuggled up, and I proposed with this little trash ring. But there was one condition, and I'm not sure that's how you should, follow up a proposal. I said, let's build this raft. Let's start our own organization and build this raft and get attention. And the raft was, imagine Kon-Tiki, this a homemade raft. It was a square deck, 20 by 20 feet, maybe 24 sailboat masts from broken sailboats. We strung them together, and we built this in Los Angeles. We took about 15,000 plastic bottles and old fishing nets and wrapped them up like 30-foot-long socks with these bottles stuck inside. And for a cabin, went to the coolest junkyard in Southern California and found a Cessna 310 aircraft, just the fuselage, and we tied the whole thing together with an A-frame mast with a square piece of old tattered sail, and we called the thing junk. And actually, Captain Charles Moore, he towed us offshore. It was myself and this other sailor, Joel Pascal. It was two of us on board, and Anna was our mission control on land. And that began our expedition. We were tossed out to sea, no motor, no chase boat. And it was an 88-day, a solid 3 months, just drifting at 1.5 knots over to Waikiki.
Now, after that, you subsequently co-founded Five Gyres. Anna, what's the significance of that name, Five Gyres?
So there are five. When people think of the island or the Texas-sized patch of garbage, which, as you appropriately pointed out, is really a myth, they're referring to these massive current systems in the oceans. It's a combination of the way the Earth is rotating, prevailing winds, and these huge currents in the ocean. They create a huge vortex, kind of like a massive whirlpool. And there are five large subtropical gyres. These gyres are concentrating plastic that flows into our oceans from really every continent in the world. So the issue that we're really trying to bring to the public is that there is no away, that what may seem like out of sight, out of mind, this plastic flowing into our oceans is actually concentrating in these gyres, creating problems for ecosystems, for wildlife, and potentially a threat to human health. So we started this organization in 2009 with a goal of expanding the research and the dialogue and ultimately the solutions around plastic pollution in the oceans to a global level. There was no research on the Southern Hemisphere gyres, so that's what we wanted to do, was really close that scientific gap and then leverage those scientific findings to drive solutions upstream.
So far, since 2009, 17 expeditions by Five Gyres, presumably not on the junk raft, but on actual research vessels. Where have you gone, and is there any place in the ocean where you can go and not find plastic?
That's a really good question. And I just came back from a conference in Germany just about maybe 15 hours ago, microplastics in freshwater environments. And we're talking about the distribution of microplastics from our streets all the way down freshwater rivers and lakes out to the sea. And from the sea, where does it go? And the reality is it really goes everywhere. In this conference, we talked about the evidence that shows what's in the most remote parts of the planet. And now I myself, we just got back from the Arctic about a month and a half ago. We found it there. In Antarctica, there's evidence of microplastics there. It's in varying concentrations, but when you look at the micro and even the nano-sized particles, down to the size of dust, we find microfibers and small, tiny, tiny plastic particles trapped in sea ice. It's blowing in the atmosphere. There was one study in Paris found that there's a fallout of microplastics on the tops of buildings. In India, we did a study looking at the surface of leaves in Delhi and found them dusted with microplastics. We have found them on the deep sea floor, beaches worldwide. So to answer your question, there is no place on the planet today that's free of plastic.
That's really quite disturbing. And, you know, you say in varying concentrations, but you've also, in the past couple of years, produced a global estimate of just how much plastic is in the oceans. First of all, how do you go about putting together a global estimate of plastic pollution? What kinds of data were you drawing on for that estimate?
So what Anna and I have done, we've chartered sailboats and gone around the world, and we skim the ocean surface, and we look at what's floating. So that estimate is what's floating only. So we drag our net. It's a fine, fine mesh. Like, the holes in the net are much smaller than the holes in your T-shirt. And we'll collect lots of zooplankton, phytoplankton, and little plastic particles. We count them. We weigh them. Then we extrapolate, based on our data, how much per square kilometer. So we get these little square kilometer little plots, you know, around the world. So I asked colleagues, I asked Captain Charles Moore, Martin Thiel from Chile, Julie Reiser from Australia, colleagues from the Mediterranean, from the coast of South Africa. We put all our data together and had a few thousand little data points, little square kilometer estimates. Then we have ocean modelers, and these are people who are mathematicians. They look at the data on where currents flow, and they create logarithms to say, if you find this concentration here, you should find this much over there. And doing that with the data and the model, we then produce this global estimate. And it's based on about 7 years of work, thousands of data points, and these great ocean models. And that's where we came at that conclusion of 269,000 metric tons from 5.25 trillion particles. And what's interesting is the majority of the weight is in the big items, like the fishing buoys, fishing nets. The majority of the count, about 92% of those 5.25 trillion particles, are smaller than a grain of rice. So if you put those 5.25 trillion particles on a map of the world, you see, like, it looks like clouds of plastics globally, with the densest storms in the middle of the gyres, even thicker storms near the coastlines, and like in the South China Sea or Bay of Bengal or Mediterranean or Gulf of Mexico. And then it trickles out around the world. And it looks kind of like the way you might look up at the skies in Los Angeles back in the 70s and see smog above our heads. The oceans look like that now when you map out the plastic. It's a plastic smog that permeates the globe. And that's what our data shows.
And another takeaway of that research, it really illustrated something we already knew going in, having been around the world's oceans and done all these expeditions and seen the problem firsthand. So these findings illustrated that the solutions are not in the ocean, that we can't go out to our world's oceans to clean them up, but we need to go upstream. And that's really one of the main messages that we're trying to convey with this science, is that in order to stem or stop the flow of plastics into our oceans, we need to begin with upstream solutions like better packaging design, better policies, innovations at the corporate level, and, of course, individual responsibility. But again, it's upstream and not out in the oceans with some sort of cleanup.
Well, and that raises the question of how all of this plastic got into the ocean in the first place. At least here in the United States, we are past the days of, you know, taking barges out to sea and just dumping trash in the ocean. So how do trillions of particles, hundreds of thousands of tons of plastic, end up in the ocean?
Well, I think we could both take a stab at answering that. The primary thing that we believe is that it begins with bad design, that plastics are fossil fuel based. They're designed to last a very, very long time. But we use this incredibly valuable material for throwaway items that have no value, like that small wrapper on a piece of candy or a chip bag, or things that at the end of their life cycle, when when we, the consumers or the citizens, are done with them, there's no value. So that's one easy way that that plastic packaging flows into our streets, into our storm drain systems, and out to sea just because it has little value. So those are the macroplastics that wind their way into the oceans. A lot of it comes from land. Some estimates calculate that roughly 80% of the plastic we see in our oceans start with land-based activities, and that can, of course, vary from region to region. The other thing is how microplastics are entering the ocean. We did some really interesting research in the Great Lakes in 2012 and 2013 in collaboration with SUNY Fredonia University, looking at plastic in the Great Lakes and finding large quantities of microplastics that we later traced back to personal care products, microbeads, exfoliants, things that are now made from plastic. And we find them commonly in things like personal care products, facial scrubs, toothpastes. So that's an example of how bad design can actually engineer plastics that go directly from the consumer's hands into our oceans, down the drain, and out to sea.
I think if we look at like the sources to the ocean, the modelers that we work with, the model predicts, the three sources. It's coming from our biggest rivers, it's coming from populated coastlines, and shipping lanes. And if you look at the kinds of waste that are coming down the pipeline through these three sources, a lot of it is single-use packaging. Like when you do the beach cleanups, you see what kind of debris is washing ashore, that's leaving shore. Like Anna said, it's a single-use throwaway packaging. Then you have to ask yourself, who's responsible for that? Is it the consumer that lost the litter, or is it the litter by design that causes waste? And I would suggest both. For example, the microbeads in our facial scrubs, it's kind of hard to blame the consumer for one tube of these facial cleansers might have up to, a quarter of a million small particles in it, all designed to be washed down the drain. And plastic bags. Like, it's very common to find those blowing out of trash cans where they were put in by consumers. And the cost of taxpayers pull those out of trees, out of storm drains. So there is a huge design element. But then there are some applications of plastic that we're okay with. I mean, right now I'm looking around me in this studio. There are technologies that have plastics, the earphones that I'm wearing, my iPhone, safety equipment in hospitals, other technologies. So plastic has its place. It's just a single-use throwaway culture that's really trashing our seas.
That's Marcus Erickson. Along with Anna Cummins, they are the co-founders of the Five Gyres Institute. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Anna Cummins and Marcus Erickson. The husband and wife team are the co-founders of the Five Gyres Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to research and education about the problem of plastic pollution in the world's oceans. Anna, what do we know at this point about the ecological effects? I mean, we hear, especially here on Cape Cod, about whales being entangled in fishing net. But as you've already pointed out, that's actually the minority of the plastic problem. Most of what we're dealing with are these microplastics the size of a grain of rice. Do we have any sense of what they're doing at an ecological level?
Sure. Well, I do want to say that, plastic pollution from macroplastics, fishing debris, that is a very big problem. I think what we're saying with this microplastic issue is that by count, there is much more of the broken down stuff than the larger stuff, which will eventually break down. But in terms of the ecological impacts, a lot has been known actually for a very long time. Starting back in the 70s, one of the first papers was written by Ed Carpenter looking at plastics in the North Atlantic. The science dates back decades in terms of the impacts on animals. We know today that over 600 different species of marine wildlife, marine mammals and birds and turtles, all kinds of different species, and now a growing list of fish are affected by our plastic pollution. They either ingest it, mistaking it for food, or they literally get entangled in it. But what we're now seeing the science focusing on is smaller and smaller particles of plastic that are being incorporated into the food chain. So beyond microplastics, we're now looking at nanoplastics. In fact, the research that Five Gyres was doing that Marcus led up in the Arctic was looking into this idea of nanoparticles contaminating our waters. We are now looking into nanoparticles of plastic in the circulatory system of bivalves, inside the stomachs of planktonic organisms that, of course, feed the larger species that ultimately feed you and I. So we know that the impacts of plastic are ecosystem-wide. Those impacts don't end with the ocean. We also see evidence of terrestrial animals, from camels to cows all over the world, that are ingesting our plastics. Mainly, it's entanglement and ingestion, and it's hundreds of thousands of different marine animals impacted by our plastic.
This seems like such an intractable problem. Are there any ways, I mean, you know, you've mentioned trying to stop the flow into the ocean, but obviously with so much plastic already in the ocean, the question becomes, is there any way to clean this up and stop all of that plastic from getting into the food chain, as you were just describing?
Well, that's interesting. That's the frequent conversation is, what is the fate of all this junk? You know, if you've got 250,000 tons of trash floating out there, I mean, is that the final resting place? And the answer is no. So it's interesting. When we've got our data, 250,000 tons, we divide that into four sizes, like things as big as beach balls to water bottle size to rice grain size fragments, and then the salt and pepper size flakes. And the smallest particles, those salt and pepper size flakes of plastics, there was 100 times less than we expected. So the ocean surface isn't the final resting place. Lots of filter feeding organisms, we think, are taking them out. They're consuming them. They release them. They excrete them as fecal pellets, and those might sink. Also, surface turbulence might drive the particles, smaller particles, down deep, or they're just settling as they get fouled by marine organisms, makes them heavy by biofouling, we call it, or they're washing ashore. But whatever the case may be, there are many marine mechanisms that are kicking it out. And you know, one great analogy, and I should mention, is remember tar balls back in the 1970s and 80s? You might walk on a beach somewhere in the world and step in a blob of tar.
Or after an oil spill, or, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I grew up in near the Gulf of Mexico, and you'd walk on the beach in southern Mississippi. My stepfather was a fisherman. Walk on the beach, and you knew when you got back home, you'd get some fingernail polish remover to get the tar out from between your toes. Well, as soon as MARPOL, which was an international agreement, when they saw this happening worldwide, they found out, they realized it was coming from oil tankers that were, you know, unloading their petroleum, then going offshore, then rinsing out all the sludge out of the hulls of their ships into the ocean. And that was creating these balls of tar and washing up on shores worldwide. So as soon as the laws came into place, and it was widespread agreement that this practice should stop, as soon as it stopped, within 5 or 10 years, the amount of tar balls on beaches worldwide, it dropped tremendously. Now, you still see it today. There are natural seeps of petroleum, but it's by far much, much less than it was in the past. And what that does, what that shows us, is if we can turn off the tap of plastic leaving our shorelines, the ocean can clean itself up. So the fate is not going to be an ocean full of trash. The fate, if we, and we have a lot of control in this, the fate could be a healthy ocean. Just got to stop doing more harm.
And to bring that analogy to a recent victory that the movement had with plastic pollution, I mentioned going into the Great Lakes in 2012 and 13 and finding evidence of microbeads, plastic pollution coming from everyday personal care products like facial scrubs and body washes. Well, what we as a movement were able to do with that science was drive a successful campaign that in a short period of time, in just a few years, resulted in a national bill being passed. President Obama signed the Microbeads Free Waters Act in 2015. And that was the result of hard work from Five Gyres, from Story of Stuff, from NRDC and Surfrider, many different groups coming together to collaboratively drive an upstream design change. So that just tells us that, you know, it is possible that we can stop this problem at the source, but it really is going to take a better understanding, better collaboration, and really holding producers responsible.
If I could add just one more thing in terms of solutions, there's no one silver bullet that's going to happen. Like Anna said, we've had some policy wins. There's a role for policy to create producer responsibility. We're seeing some really cool design things happen. There's one organization called Think Beyond Plastics, and they are like they fast track innovations to replace the single use throwaway culture. There's another one called the Plastic Design Lab, trying to reinvent some of throwaway products to find smarter alternatives. So you're seeing public education growing tremendously. There are so many organizations now that are showing the public what the impacts are. So I think there's, from so many different areas, from industry, policy, education, engineers and design, that are tackling this head on. And I think it's very solvable in the next 5 or 10 years.
On the Five Gyres website, you ask people to take a plastic-free pledge. What are you really asking people to do with that?
What we're really asking people to do is to get engaged. We, having seen the scope of this problem globally, we know that solutions are not ultimately going to come from small everyday actions. But those everyday actions, when we scale them, can really add up to creating a movement, to creating a constituency of people who care about the problem enough to take action in their everyday life. So we do acknowledge that people bringing their own bags and bringing their own bottles alone is not going to solve the problem. But it does take citizens getting active, getting engaged, voting with their pocketbook, voting for the right policies and policymakers. So it's a small step for people to just take some action and use that small action to start to drive bigger involvement.
Anna Cummins and Marcus Erickson are the co-founders of the Five Gyres Institute. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anna and Marcus are visiting Cape Cod National Seashore on October 10th for a screening of the film Plastic Paradise. You can find a link to more information on our website, capeandislands.org. And that's our show. Thanks to our colleagues at NPR West for engineering help on today's show. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.